Hi everybody, welcome to History of Asia. For those of you who don't know, in this show we examine the history of every Asian region, but we do it anti-chronologically. In other words, we start in the present and then ask ourselves, how did this state of affairs come into being? Then to answer that question, we step into our time machine, travel back a few decades or centuries, and see how things got to that point. Now, we're currently talking about Iran. And in the previous two episodes, we discussed the long and noteworthy rule of the Sasanians. The reason that I took two full episodes to talk about them is testament to how cool I think these people were, or rather, how intriguing, for I wouldn't want to live under them. But more importantly, they had a really big impact on the history, not just of Iran, but of the whole Middle East and the world more generally. One of the things that made them so special and what allowed them to leave such a mark is the fact that they managed to centralize power, not against today's standards, but far more than was common in that time period, and in that region in particular. As I mentioned before, Iran is often compared to a mountain fortress, meaning that different parts are relatively easy to defend simply because of the topography. The mountains and deserts are a real pain in the behind for any power that tries to enforce central authority, and the fact that the Sasanians managed to do this to an impressive degree shows you just how formidable they were. However, in the period that preceded them, the period we are now going to talk about, such centralized rule did not exist. And in that respect, this period, ranging more or less from the 3rd century BCE to the 3rd century CE, is more typical of Iranian history. We've discussed a couple of methods through which the Sasanians managed to amass power. You had the spectacular victories against the Romans. You had the income that came from the rich plains of Mesopotamia. You had these fantastic priests, these magi, that would come in and enforce orthodoxy. And then you had the cultural seduction of the nobility. Rather than being the star players in their local team, they decided they'd rather play for the big team with the accompanying paycheck, the fancy dressing room, and the champagne, even if that meant they just had to keep the bench warm. You had all that and a lot of other elements, but how could you tell which of these really made a difference and which were just, well, nice to have, but wouldn't work on their own, probably? If only we had some sort of control group, right? Then we can conduct a laboratory experiment. Well, it just so happens that the rulers that preceded the Sasanians, the Seleucids and the Parthians, also did some of these things that the Sasanians did, and yet they didn't even come close to the level of centralization and control that the Sasanians had. To be clear, that is not to say that they were therefore inferior or something. Rather, a comparison of their systems would show that both can work, that they both have their own strengths and weaknesses. But let me start by giving you a broad idea of where we are now in Iranian history. Around 330 BCE, Alexander the Great conquered the most famous Persian Empire, the one of Cyrus and Xerxes, along with some other territories. But he left no designated heir, and so, unsurprisingly, his subordinates clashed with each other after his death. One of them, Seleucus, carved out the largest part of the conquered lands for himself and his successors, who became known as the Seleucids. The Seleucid Empire didn't formally end until the last of its domains was annexed by the famous Roman general Pompey the Great in 664 BCE. By then, however, the largest part of their domain had long been taken over by the Parthians, which partly explains why Pompey had so little trouble mopping up the rest of the once mighty Seleucid Empire. The Parthians would prove a much more formidable opponent. The Parthian royal family, known as the Arsacid dynasty, remained formally in charge of the Middle East until their deposal by the Sasanians in 224 AD. And even after that, a branch of their family clung on in Armenia until the early 5th century, which would mean that the Seleucid kingdom lasted for 2 centuries in some capacity, and the Parthian one 5 or even 7, depending on how you count. That is an impressively long time, no matter how you frame it. For comparison, the state of Germany exists for just over a century and a half now. Few countries that exist today are as old as any of these empires. So we should avoid seeing them as failures to be contrasted with the so-called successful Sasanians. The reality is much more nuanced, but also more interesting. Completely different approaches to governing may both achieve a significant measure of success, at least in terms of longevity. This should not be so surprising. A country like Switzerland is ultra-decentralized, while France is very centralized, and yet both have been around for quite some time, and they don't seem to be going anywhere, I think. That said, if you just look at the official starting and ending dates of these empires, the impression you get is rather misleading. Let me tell you what I mean. In the later years of their reign, the Seleucids only controlled a very small swath of territory that was in no way comparable to the vast domain that they held earlier. So was that really the same dynasty in any meaningful sense? For comparison, it's often said that the Roman Empire lasted until 1453, when the city of Constantinople fell. But by then, that city was the only thing that remained of the Roman Empire that once dominated from the Atlantic to the Euphrates. Was it still the same empire? Well, in a sense, yes, but in most meaningful ways, not really. Likewise, during long periods, the only sense in which the Seleucid and Parthian empires existed was that they were still ruled by Seleucids or Arsacists respectively. But in reality, competing barons often used some member of the royal family as a puppet king. And besides, the king didn't always come from the same branch of the family tree even. So, does that even count as a dynasty then? At some point, whether an empire exists at all becomes almost a semantic discussion, don't you think? And perhaps we overstate the importance of the family name of the ruler anyway. When the royal family eventually did change, that in itself didn't impact things on the ground all that much. The Parthians famously left Greek cities and institutions intact as much as they could, while the takeover of their lands by the Sasanians seems to have been little more than a change of the guard, at least in the beginning. So in a way, the official lifespans of empires obscure more than they reveal. This, by the way, is one reason why I avoid mentioning too many dates. That and the fact that it makes for boring audio, of course. But if there are any lessons to be learned from studying long-gone people, you certainly won't learn them by memorizing bullet points on a timeline, at least in my humble opinion. And the same goes for the names of kings, so I don't mention many of these either. Granted, personal stories and the individuals in them can serve as a framework to help you keep track of things, but not in the case of the Arsacids and the Seleucids, believe me. For both only used a small number of names, and these keep returning, like Antiochus for the Seleucids and Mithridates for the Parthians. And it becomes even more confusing as these names are also common in other empires in the region at the time. Come to think of it, even the name Parthians is itself misleading. See, there had long existed a province in Persia known as Parthia, dating back to the time of Herodotus. And if I'm not mistaken, he even mentions Parthians at some point in his work. But the Arsacid kings didn't come from that region. They originally led a semi-nomadic people from the Central Asian steppe known as the Parni. When the Seleucids were busy fighting one another, and the governor of Parthia took advantage of this to go his own way, the Parni figured, hey, instead of a giant empire, this is now a smallish kingdom, ripe for the picking. So they took it over. The Arsacids then ruled this now independent province until the Seleucids got their act together. Then they forced them to recognize their subservience. So at that point, the Arsacids were like governors or satraps in the Seleucid state. Not for long, though. When the opportunity came, they broke away again, which would mean that the Seleucids would see them as rebels now and regarded the Parthian lands as still theirs. A recipe for constant war. There were also moments when the Parthians went onto the offensive, though. It was a very long struggle, in which then this side was up, and then the other. At the end of it all, the Parthians conquered most of the Seleucid Empire, and what remained would be easy pickings for the Romans. So what can we learn from this period? Are there any events or processes in this era with truly lasting consequences? That's above all what we're interested in here. Well, yes, but I must admit, compared to other periods, they are few and far between. That is to say, I found them hard to find, at least. And perhaps that's not so strange. Historical events are like marks of footsteps in the sand. The more time passes, the more they tend to disappear. And by this point, we are talking about a time period that we didn't even cover at all in the series on Arabia. Because back then, the Arabian Peninsula was, for all intents and purposes, still living in prehistory. So I found little useful to say about it. And up to a point, this problem exists in the case of Parthia too. Not that the Parthians were illiterate, far from it. We know that there were whole histories written by Parthians about Parthia. It's just that they have been irretrievably lost. So they are of little use to us. And that, it seems, is mostly thanks to the Sasanians, who wanted to wipe out all the traces of the dynasty that they usurped, and which they declared was in league with the forces of evil. Ironically, relatively little has survived from the Sasanian era for the same reason. The Muslim Arabs weren't too keen on honoring their heathen heritage either. It is not an uncommon problem with Iranian regimes. In China, by contrast, every new dynasty was expected to write the history of the one that it replaced. But in Iran, though there are exceptions, they didn't always seem too keen on honoring the heritage of their predecessors. And not without reason, by the way. There is always the lingering threat of a comeback. Qajar nobles like Mossadegh remained prominent under the Pahlavis, for instance. Parthian nobles would stay on as barons under the Sasanians, and they even kept ruling the nearby kingdom of Armenia. The last Shah of Iran had returned once already, and until his death, the Ayatollahs kept fearing a repeat of that scenario. The result is that, unfortunately, what we know about the Parthians has mostly come down to us from their Roman rivals, and their viewpoint is obviously marred by prejudice. Plutarch, for instance, loves to mock their so-called effeminate looks, mentioning their use of eyeshadow, for instance. The Romans mistook their slick hit-and-run tactics for cowardice, and the fact that they behaved humbly towards their kings was seen as a sign that they were a slave state. These stereotypes mostly date back to the time of Herodotus, by the way, when Greeks looked with condescension, and perhaps more than a bit of jealousy, towards their mighty and prosperous neighbor to the east. The stereotype of the decadent, tyrannical Easterner has proved incredibly stubborn, of course. I read the essays of Michel de Montaigne recently, and he quotes Plutarch every 10 sentences, so to speak. It's unbelievable. It may not be surprising that the Roman views on Parthia persisted, so. What is surprising, I think, is that the Romans didn't adapt their opinion themselves, for they would soon discover, to their shame, that these views were very misguided indeed. The confrontation between Rome and Parthia is often put forward as a typical example of how big empires can never hope to peacefully coexist. For they famously fought a lot, these two, didn't they? These days, it's all the rage to mention the infamous Thucydides trap, which posits that war inevitably follows whenever a new power rises in a political ecosystem dominated by a hegemon. It's usually brought up to prophesy that America and China will soon go to war with one another, since practically the whole world has now been America's playground for a decade or two. I personally think it's downright irresponsible for politicians to claim to believe that conflict is inevitable. But that aside, more to the point, the situation with Parthia and Rome might rather serve as a rebuttal of the Thucydides trap theory, I think. For although, yes, spectacular clashes did happen, but given the fact that they lived door to door for centuries, these were not all that numerous. More often than not, theirs was a cold war in a state of détente. That said, the theory of Thucydides may not really apply to them anyway, for by the time that Rome and Persia came into direct contact, they were both hegemons in their own respective ecosystem already. This made it easier for them to draw a line in the sand and then respect that line. No one needed to give up anything he already had. They could establish good working relations. For the sake of keeping trade flowing, they even had an interest in the stability of the other, you might say. All in the markets together, and no need at all then to mention war, right? Indeed, this is more or less what the future looked like when the first high-level negotiation between the two countries took place. When the Roman commander Sulla met the Persian envoy, the two of them agreed that the Euphrates would be their border, a natural boundary and hard to cross. What made this settlement collapse was not some inevitable law of nature, but contingent choices made by individuals, mostly stupid ones, as well as internal dynamics within both countries. It was perhaps a bad omen that the Persian diplomat who sealed the deal would be executed because he supposedly allowed Sulla to treat him as less than an equal, thereby humiliating Persia, which would not be out of tune for Roman diplomacy in this period, and for Sulla in particular. But even if the Romans officially presented the relationship with Persia as almost a vassalage, that shouldn't mean it would inevitably collapse. After all, the Chinese emperor would commonly present all trade as tribute, to be rewarded with generous gifts. And usually the deal could be presented honorably to both audiences anyway, there was no problem. Apparently the Persians didn't resent the agreement all that much either, because they stuck to it regardless. Now, this was an important moment in the history of Rome also, as you probably know. The legions won practically every battle that they fought, and prominent politicians vied with each other for the honor and the profits that came from commanding them. This led to an incredible expansion of Roman territory, but also of their personal fortunes and of the stakes in their contests, especially since the legions became bound to their commanders rather than the state. The very presence of Sulla in the east had to do with this. He clashed with his rival Marius over who should be given command over the lucrative campaign against King Mithridates of Pontus. The contest between Marius and Sulla eventually led to a bloody civil war, at the end of which Sulla secured his position as the sole ruler of Rome, giving him little reason left for further foreign adventures. But the next generation of ambitious politicians was already waiting impatiently in the wings. The return of their vicious rivalries would not only tear Rome apart and end its existence as a republic, it would also restart the expansion and bring Rome in conflict with Persia. I'm sure you all heard about the triumvirate of Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus. For a while, these three powerful men ruled Rome together. And at first, Crassus was perhaps the strongest of the three. He certainly had the most money, but he lacked the glory of the others. Caesar won legendary victories in Gaul, while Pompey did the same in the Mediterranean. Crassus, though long past the age when it was seen as appropriate to seek such honors, desperately wanted his own triumph, and he had his eyes set on the biggest prize around, Persia. Probably even wanted to emulate Alexander, making his way to the legendary wealth of India. That would not be so unusual. Caesar and Pompey famously compared themselves to Alexander too. Perhaps the Romans could have seen this as a bad sign for their liberty, as Alexander's father had ended Greek liberty in many ways. In the case of Crassus, the public didn't look kindly on such ambitions, though. His endeavor was unpopular, which is very uncharacteristic for the period. The Romans were usually very gung-ho about any new adventures. A tribune even cursed Crassus as he marched off to what turned out to be his destiny. It must be that his critics had a better understanding of Persian power than Crassus himself. Perhaps indicative of his overconfidence was that he didn't accept the Armenian king's offer of traveling through his mountains. Instead, the Romans took the direct route into the Persian heartland in Mesopotamia. When he encountered the Persian army, Crassus wasn't impressed, for it was much smaller and more poorly equipped than his own legionaries, it would seem. But he failed to appreciate one crucial detail. The Parthians were all of them on horseback. Why was this so important? Well, it reminds me of how Ricky Gervais once compared the Falkland War to a giant holding a midget by the nose while kicking him in the bollocks, meaning that the Argentine guns couldn't fire as far as the British Navy could, so they couldn't retaliate when they were shot at. I don't know if any of that's true, but supposing it was, then this would be similar. The Parthians had already won before they started. They shot at the Roman foot soldiers from a distance, and because they were all mounted, they could easily avoid contact with them. The legionaries could never get close enough to use their gladius and pilum. All that they could hope for was that their enemies would run out of arrows eventually. But that hope was soon dashed. Not only were the Parthian bows so powerful that they could pierce their armor and shields, they made sure to show how their archers were supplied with a flow of fresh munitions. That was the death blow for Roman morale. They now knew that they couldn't wait out the hail of arrows. They had to get close to their enemy or they would die where they stood. This allowed the Parthians to show the trick that they would become famous for, turning around in the saddle and shooting their pursuers as they ran away. This acrobatic trick had long been practiced on the Asian steppe, but because this was the first time that the Romans got to experience it, it became known to history as the Parthian shot. It probably helps that it sounds a lot like parting shot, which is kind of what it means, I guess. Even if some Roman horsemen could make contact, they were no match for the Parthian heavy cavalry. These were the prototypes of the cataphracts that would come to dominate the Byzantine and Sasanian armies later on. In fact, it was the demise of Crassus that made it clear to the Romans that they should really have more cavalry in their armies. They could hardly forget this lesson anyway, for this would not be a close-run thing at all. It would be a massacre, and that was not something that the proud Romans were used to. In fact, they would try desperately to retrieve the standards that would be lost here. After his son and sub-commander had died in a desperate attempt to turn the tide, Crassus also came to understand that his position was hopeless, that he would not even make it home alive unless he could strike a deal. Perhaps he was also convinced by escaped Roman prisoners who had overheard how eager the Parthians were to make concessions. Or perhaps these were allowed to overhear this and then freed so as to bring Crassus to the negotiating table. If so, that would be a sneaky move. Shamelessly copied by the makers of Game of Thrones, by the way. Whatever the Parthians' real intentions, during the negotiations, a skirmish broke out, in which Crassus was slain. And if this were really an unfortunate accident, then how to explain what happens next? For instead of trying to continue negotiations, the Parthians cut the commander's head off and sent it eastward. It would act as a piece of entertainment at an important wedding, that between the sister of the Armenian king and the son of the Parthian ruler. Through this marriage, the Armenians officially shifted their allegiance from Rome to Parthia. So this celebration put an exclamation mark on the Roman humiliation. According to the story, the guests of honor at the wedding were just enjoying a Greek play known as the Bacchae. It's a famous story about wild women, worshippers of the god Dionysus or Bacchus, who tore a man to pieces in a drunken trance. The messenger arrived just in time, so that Crassus's head could be used as a fitting attribute in the play, to liven up the performance, make it a bit more realistic. Not exactly a way of saying, "Sorry we accidentally killed your commander, can we have peace now?" The Parthians were probably all too aware of what was brewing in Rome, and that this would present more opportunities for them. During the next civil war, they offered their allegiance to Pompey in return for territorial concessions. Pompey wasn't keen, however. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if he had acted otherwise. When he fled from Caesar, instead of going to Parthia, He chose Egypt as his destination, where he was betrayed and murdered. The Parthians would presumably have acted otherwise. But they weren't done meddling quite yet. Caesar was murdered by Brutus and Cassius Longinus, and he fought then against those who wanted to revenge his death. But they were on the verge of losing, and the Parthians then intervened by providing them with fresh troops, so that the conflict might continue a bit more. No hurt feelings on the part of the Parthians, apparently, since the same Cassius had invaded them with Crassus not long ago, and he had only narrowly escaped with his life at the time. Mark Antony then tried his luck invading Parthia, perhaps again to outdo his rival Octavian in the eyes of the public and gain further riches. He took a smarter approach than Crassus, avoiding the open plains and using more cavalry, but he failed nonetheless. His baggage train was attacked, and without his siege equipment, he had no chance of taking any walled cities. His troops were harassed by Parthian arrow fire as they stumbled all the way back to Roman territory. And to hammer the message home, the Parthians then launched raids into Roman Syria, making it practically ungovernable. When the civil war in Rome finally came to an end, Octavian, better known as Emperor Augustus, made peace with the Parthians. He so managed to negotiate the return of the standards and many of the war captives that had been lost by the campaigns of Crassus and Antony. Armenia became a buffer state ruled by a member of the Parthian royal family, but crowned, more or less, by the Romans. As he had no more rivals at home, Augustus didn't have the same incentives to attack such powerful enemies anymore. As we all know, wars are often enacted against the interests of the invading country, but because of the insecurity of its ruler. With Augustus, the ruler of Rome was no longer feeling insecure, which meant that peace was now possible. It was also in the interests of the Parthians. There were no more open divisions in Rome for them to exploit now. The peace wouldn't last forever, though. The Parthians had profited from the Roman civil wars, but the shoe would soon be on the other foot now. And in a way, it started immediately after the defeat of Crassus even. The Parthian army was traditionally led by a member of a leading noble family, the Suren. Now, by destroying the legions of Crassus, this commander had acquired so much fame that he became perceived as a contender for the throne of Parthia itself. So he was quickly done away with, which led to a large uproar in the east of the empire. The situation is very reminiscent of what happened with the commander Abu Muslim after he brought the Abbasid caliphs to power, as you'll remember. Victory itself can sometimes be a harbinger of problems. So too can peace. To seal the peace deal, Octavian gifted a very special slave to his Parthian counterpart, a beautiful Italian girl named Musa. She soon became the king's most trusted consort, and she bore him a son, which elevated her to the status of queen. She then apparently convinced her husband to send his other sons to Rome. As I said in the last episode, this sort of thing would still happen with their respective successors, the Sasanians and the Byzantines. And in this case, too, the boys would be treated very well, as they might. The Roman emperor must have been very happy with this development. Perhaps Musa had received instructions beforehand, but once in Parthia, she was of course free to act according to her own interests. And these lay with her son, who was now the uncontested heir to the Parthian throne. The only one who still stood in his way was the king himself, and conveniently he was soon poisoned. Musa's son then ascended the throne, and he promptly married his mother. You really couldn't make this stuff up. Or perhaps you could, for it sounds a lot like the tale of Oedipus, doesn't it? The Parthians, who were very familiar with such Greek tragedies, may have noticed that too. Now, this story is interesting on many levels, but the most important is that it was perceived badly by the public of Parthia. Now, you might think that that goes without saying, but as we saw in the last episode, under the Sasanians, the priests actively encouraged incestuous marriages. By then, they were extremely highly thought of, apparently. Not yet, it seems, in this period. One scholar I read thinks that the Zoroastrian religion was still in another stage, and that such customs among magi, like incestuous unions, were not yet widely spreading to the larger populace. Like also exposing the dead to wild animals. These customs came into fashion only slowly, according to this theory. Well, perhaps, but as we will see in later episodes, incestuous unions were also exceptionally common in the royal courts of older Persian civilizations, and even among the Macedonian nobility, so who the heck knows, right? Another possibility, at least I think, is that it had more to do with the fact that Musa was Roman, and that she may have been seen as acting on behalf of the Parthians' mortal enemy, which she very well may have been, for this would all play very nicely into the hands of the Roman emperor, of course. Anyway, the new king was very unpopular, and he wouldn't last long. But since all the people that could replace him were back in Rome, the Parthians had little choice but to ask for their return. That request was gladly granted. Only, the new prince had grown up a Roman, and so had in many respects really become Roman. He didn't show much interest in horses or hunting, for instance. It was a triumph of nurture over nature, you might say, and this grated his countrymen. It might seem like a good idea to send a prince to a rival country to foment ties, but this shows that there are downsides to this approach. In fact, the coming period would be very tumultuous for Persia, with many patricides and fratricides and repeated civil wars. The Romans obviously took advantage. In the many internal conflicts to come, they would intervene and sometimes help their favorite climb the Parthian throne. However, just like with the Sasanian king Khosrow II, this fact would make them pretty unloved among their subjects, a recipe for further chaos. What was also a constant source of trouble was Armenia. It would remain a buffer state, as well as the source of conflict between Rome and Persia. Even after the Parthians were eventually supplanted by the Sasanians. In fact, it became even more problematic then, since at least under the Parthians, there was an agreement that you could always return to, namely, that an Arsacid would sit on the Armenian throne, but that he would be officially installed with the approval of the Romans. The Sasanians would never be okay with that, of course, as the Arsacids were their mortal rivals, and nor would the Romans ever approve an Armenian king put forward by the Sasanians. When Armenia and Rome both became Christian, this added an ideological layer to the problem. Most disagreements between Persia and Rome, or Byzantium later, had to do with the Caucasus. And later on, this would once again be the case, as both Turkey and Iran had become Muslim, while the Caucasus would remain Christian. Since Muslims could in theory not be enslaved, the Ottomans and the Safavids both came to see these mountains as the best place to find that important raw material, human labor, and they fought over it, like modern nations would fight over oil wells. And today, it's still a war zone, as Christian Armenia and Muslim Azerbaijan fight it out with the backing of Russia and Turkey, respectively. This seems to be a permanent feature of the Caucasus region, and in a way, fittingly so, for these mountains were formed by tectonic plates smashing into each other. Their collision created the rich mineral deposits that make them attractive targets, and the activity keeps causing seismic shocks on a regular basis. Similarly, the region seems forever stuck between shifting ethno-religious continental plates, causing regular earthquakes. As I said, Armenia was often the official cause of war, but sometimes it was just used as a pretext. Like with the Emperor Trajan, for instance. Like Caesar and Crassus before him, he too dreamt of emulating Alexander the Great. And he felt like the time was ripe. Persia was completely divided at the time. So he used a disagreement over the installment of a new Armenian king as an excuse to invade. Now Trajan was a very competent general who learned from the mistakes of Crassus and Antony, not only by taking advantage of his foes' internal troubles, but also by making better use of the terrain. He first moved through the Armenian mountains and then crossed parts of Mesopotamia by river wherever he could. And so he reached the Parthian capital of Ctesiphon with his siege weapons still intact and was able to take it, and other cities too, by the way. But he had trouble consolidating his victories. I guess you could compare it a little bit to the recent American invasion of that same region in the recent past. Securing the cities was the easy part, relatively speaking at least. But what do you do when the people refuse to cooperate? And Trajan couldn't keep giving his full attention to Parthia anyway, since other regions of his empire rose in revolt too. The Romans controlled some important cities for a time, but these weren't as important as they would become under the Sasanians anyway. The tribes could make things very hard for any government that they didn't accept. It was not without reason, after all, that the Parthians had used such a hands-off approach. They left local tribes and rulers enough autonomy so that they would wish to keep it that way and fight for a king who allowed that. For if there were a new boss in town, these jolly days might be over. New bosses, new rules, right? And just like the Seleucids, the Romans were not exactly known for their flexibility. Perhaps you could compare it a bit to how the Greek city-states united against the invading Persians some centuries earlier. They were proud of their democracy, while Persia was known as a despot state, so they were willing to fight and die for their relative freedom. Perhaps something similar was going on here with the Parthians. Indeed, in a broad sense, I guess you could say that flexibility was the hallmark of Parthian success. When the Arsacids arrived on the scene in Parthia as semi-nomadic invaders, they uncharacteristically merged with the local Parthian elite right away. This is why it's all in all not inaccurate to call them Parthians anyway. They were soon indistinguishable from the original Parthians. While they expanded their territory, though, they also embraced elements of the identity of other important groups that they found there. Take the image of the ruler, for instance. They embraced the ruler cult that Alexander's successors had adopted, the idea of divine kingship. But they also took on the old Persian title, King of Kings, which was kind of appropriate since their barons remained kings in their own fiefdoms. And from the Persian kings, they adopted the looks, including the eyeshadow and the colored beard, all these attributes that the Romans would find so effeminate. Or take their governmental methods. They honored the ancient practice of dividing the land into satrapies, but in practice, the level of independence varied widely. They left intact the special status of the Greek cities, where they stationed few or no Parthian garrisons, and they negotiated settlements with nomadic peoples in the terminology that the steppe peoples were used to. This no doubt often helped secure peace on that otherwise volatile eastern border. This flexible approach contrasts sharply with the Seleucid approach, or the Roman one for that matter. The Macedonians and Greeks tried to remain the dominant group in the lands that they conquered by separating themselves from the mass of their subjects, and they would never dream of compromising with tribal barbarians on their borders as they saw them, let alone using their vocabulary. It's a different attitude that is likelier to cause offense, I think, and conflict. But it can also achieve its goals, at least for a time. You can bend with the wind or stand firm and hope that you won't break. The Parthians' flexibility also allowed them to absorb whatever worked from different styles of warfare to their advantage. They never abandoned the nomadic specialty of horse archery, of course, but they also employed Greek and even Roman officers, who they assumed would know best how to fight other Greeks and Romans. They may even have brought some of Crassus's captured soldiers to the extreme east of their empire to fight on their behalf. Signs of their presence have been found around western China. But the Parthians were no mere copycats. They also introduced completely new concepts, like the cataphract. As we said already, these would have a long-term impact on warfare, and not just in this region. They are also responsible for innovations in other areas. In art, for instance, they initiated frontal depictions of faces, and this would become so popular that it became a hit even in Europe. I don't find it hard to see why. If a painting seems to look you right in the eye, that is more appealing than if it just seems to ignore you, right? And a more personal touch was in vogue anyway. You could see that in popular philosophies like Stoicism, that taught the individual how to live his life, or in these newfangled mystery cults that seem to appear all over the place. Speaking of which, one of these cults may well be the most enduring legacy of the wars between Rome and Persia. Some scholars argue that during the disastrous Persian campaigns, the Roman soldiers picked up a belief in a deity called Mithras. Their secret cult then quickly spread to Rome and some corners of its empire. It would remain especially popular among soldiers. Now, those of you with a good memory may remember that Mithra was an ancient god worshipped by the people that migrated to Iran millennia ago. He was associated with the sun and with oath-keeping, among other things. With the rise of Zoroastrianism, he evolved into a lesser divine being. Now, although this Mithras bears relatively little resemblance to the figure that became popular in Rome in the wake of the Persian Wars, it seems not so crazy to imagine that some Persians had invoked him during battle and that the Romans had overheard this. Now, this is just my own totally unqualified hypothesis, but what I think may have happened here is that they reasoned, these Persians must have a mighty powerful god on their side if he grants them such victories against the odds. It probably won't hurt if I try to worship this Mithra for a change. Well, perhaps it didn't literally happen that way, but in antiquity it was perfectly normal to attribute the victory or the defeat of an army to the favor, disfavor, or power of the gods that they sacrificed to. This, after all, is how Constantine embraced the Christian god, as an experiment. He had painted crosses on his men's shields at the crucial Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and since he won that battle, he concluded that the Christian god had handed him victory, and had thereby shown that he rewarded those that respected him. And so the Emperor Constantine reverted to Christianity, with all the consequences that that entailed. And by the way, something very similar would happen later on with Clovis. So this explanation sounds logical to me, but the evidence is just too flimsy. On the origins of Mithraism, historians disagree with each other 180 degrees, and since their standpoints are nothing but educated guesses anyway due to a lack of sources, well, I reckoned I might just as well throw my own uneducated guess in there for once, at the risk of embarrassing myself, of course. Take it for what it's worth. Now, I still haven't told you why this is, or may be, so important. The cult of Mithras doesn't exist anymore, so who cares? Well, Mithraism became the big competitor to early Christianity, which would appear in Rome shortly after. They were clearly fishing in the same pond, these two. The similarities between them are hard to overlook. They are so many, in fact, that early Christians fretted openly about that, like, they're doing it on purpose. It's a trick of the devil to corrupt our beliefs. Here are some examples, so that you would know what I mean. First of all, not totally unlike Jesus, Mithras was seen as a savior. Like early Christians, his followers met in secret. You could only join if you went through an initiation ceremony, a kind of baptism. They too would have a communal feast, which also was a ritual reenactment of a famous meal that Mithra supposedly had someday. And last but not least, Mithras's birthday would be the 25th of December. What do you think? Coincidence? Now, if you're a Christian, don't be offended. But no one really knows for certain when Christ was actually born. I believe most scholars today even think it was in 5 before Christ, which is kind of funny if you think about it. That would mean we'd have to adjust our old calendar if we'd be consequential. Good thing we don't do that, would make things kind of confusing. But anyway, it tells you something that they can't even agree on the year. So how certain would they ever be about the day, do you think? Not very certain, to say the least. It's just a matter of tradition. And traditions are flexible. As if to prove my point, this was illustrated again just a couple of days ago. Orthodox Christians have a different tradition. They celebrate Christmas on the 7th of January. But as you may have heard, there are some issues between Ukraine and Russia lately, so the Church of Ukraine has now decided to move the birthday of Christ to the 25th of December. You can do that, apparently. Now, I also have my birthday parties when the weather is nice, so why not? Now, in fairness, I don't think many scholars would say that it's because of the Partial Wars that Santa drops by when he does. But whether the date was chosen because of Mithras or because of some other pagan festival, I think it's still a good reminder that ancient history from faraway places continues to determine your life, up to and including when best-selling books and rock albums come out, or when you will get that new tie you always wanted. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening. Till next time. Bye.